Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 130 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Sabalski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. If you're a regular listener, you'll know I don't tend to stray too far into the early modern period of English history on the podcast, much as I may love my Shakespeare. The Tudors get a lot of coverage pretty much everywhere, in part because they're such a fascinating and turbulent dynasty. But for this episode, I've made an exception, because what perhaps gets less coverage is just how deeply the Tudors themselves cared about the medieval period, especially the trappings of courtly love. This week, I spoke with Sarah Gristwood about her new book, The Tudors in Love, The Courtly Code Behind the Last Medieval Dynasty. Sarah is the author of many best-selling books, including Arbella, England's Lost Queen, and Blood Sisters, The Women Behind the Wars of the Roses. In her latest book, Sarah dives into the courtly love traditions that so heavily influenced the Tudors, for better and for worse. Here's our conversation on the ways in which some of the world's most famous kings and queens played with medieval culture, how it shaped them, and how it shaped history. Now, thank you, Sarah, for joining me to talk about Tudors in Love. It's such a pleasure to meet you.
And you.
I'm so happy to have you here. So a lot of people have talked about the Tudor story many, many times, and you've taken this on with a different perspective. What's the perspective you take on the Tudors this time around?
Yes. Well, as you say, I mean, the Tudors, they're not only our most fascinating dynasty, they have to be our most extensively covered. But, I'm coming in from the perspective of, another 700 years of history, because I'm coming in from the perspective of courtly love, a creed that was already centuries old when the Tudors came to the throne of England, but which I'd say coloured and in a way licensed a whole lot of their behaviours, a whole lot of the things that fascinate us. And of course, we tend to think now of the Tudors as our first modern dynasty, but their own preferred currency was the past. You know, they were a new dynasty on the make with a pretty shaky blood claim to the English throne. And so what they needed was to ally themselves to generations before, rather than, hey, we're going to lead you into the future. And that's really where the subtitle comes in. I know it raises a few eyebrows to call the Tudors our last medieval dynasty, but I'd say there's a strong element of truth in it.
Now you'll have a whole podcast to make your case. Okay, so to start with, for the people who are maybe listening to this podcast for the first time, can you tell us what courtly love is, especially from your perspective?
Yeah, absolutely. Though that said, I'm still working on my snappy one-line answer. I haven't got there yet, but then there's an awful lot to cover. Think of a picture. It's almost the archetypal medieval picture people who weren't medievalists would have in their head. What do you see? You see a knight kneeling in front of a beautiful lady, you know, kneeling in service. Maybe there's a sword in her hand and she's dubbing him. Of course, that picture, the way we see it, comes to us through the Victorians, who absolutely fell in love with this, you know, revived this whole idea again, tournaments and all sorts. But in reality, it was born late 12th century, I'd say, well, born perhaps in the songs of the troubadours, but really codified in the late 12th century at the court of Marie de Champagne, Eleanor of Aquitaine's daughter, by her first marriage to Louis of France. And there, Eleanor instructed Chrétien de Troyes to write down for the first time the story of Lancelot and Guinevere. Arthurian stories, of course, were very old news by now, but this aspect of them, Lancelot and Guinevere, one of the aspects that's still most present to us today, really hit the headlines here. And it was likely, not certain, but very possibly also at Marie's court, that one Andreas Capellanus, Andrew the Chaplain, wrote a book on loving, actually laying down rules for courtly love. Now, he may have had his tongue ever so slightly in his cheek when he did it. I mean, he painted this wonderful picture of ladies like Mary, like Eleanor, like Ermengarde de Narbonne, presiding over actual courts of love and giving their judgment on such knotty points like, was true love within marriage even possible? They decided it wasn't. I know. But nonetheless, there was an idea there real enough and with enough emotional strength to it that it stuck around for centuries. Changed colour over the years, of course, you know, fell in and out of favour to some degree. The church's attitude on it shifted. But nonetheless, writers Dante, Petrarch, Chaucer all made use of it in different ways. And particularly because it had become so allied to the Arthurian stories, it was ready and waiting when the Tudors came along.
Yes. And if we stop for a second right here, one of the things that you mention in the book is that tension between the church and the culture of courtly love, because courtly love is based on adultery, is based on flirting, if not outright fornication. So how was this kind of tense at the time?
Yeah, totally tense and much debated over the centuries, much debated. Because as you say, the weird thing, the really weird thing about courtly love is it is meant to be an adulterous relationship in that the lady is likely to be already married and to someone else. If we take Chrétien de Troyes, take his Lancelot and Guinevere, I mean, it is seriously peculiar. On the one hand, you've got King Arthur's wife having it off with his best friend. And in Chrétien, you know, whatever, in later, other versions maybe had this as a, you know, platonic love, but Chrétien makes no bones about it. And he has very strange things, like Lancelot genuflects as he leaves the door of Guinevere's chamber, as if at a religious shrine. He finds a comb of hers, discarded by the road, and because it's got a few of her hairs caught in it, he begins to worship it as if it were some kind of religious artifact. I mean, today you'd tell him to get a grip or to seek professional help and quickly. But nonetheless, at a time when church and state alike would demand the highest penalties for adultery, certainly for a woman's adultery, Lancelot and Guinevere are meant to be honoured for the ardour of their love. You know, yes. And this is really, I can't quite get my head around this, and nor is anybody else over the last 7 centuries.
Yeah, one of the things you mentioned in the book, and that a lot of scholars have said too, is that it might just be a perfect fantasy for those nobles who are always placed in a marriage that is political for the most part. And that's something that comes up later when we get to the Tudors, right?
Sure. I mean, I think, yes, of course, it was a fantasy. But the fact is, no fantasy sticks around as long as this one did, unless there is some kind of emotional reality. Now, the question of whether it was just a literary game is a big one. And it's why, in a way, despite its longevity, courtly love, and of course the term only came into popular use in the 19th century, it's one of the least reputable terms in history. I mean, C.S. Lewis, great medievalist, of course, as well as the creator of Narnia, said back in the 1930s that courtly love was a movement compared to which the Renaissance was a mere ripple on the surface of literature. But give it a few decades, skeptical 1960s, one professor, Robertson, I think it was complaining that half his colleagues were teaching medieval text to the tune of Hearts and Flowers. As you know, he and many others were saying that this was just a rather, you know, recondite, recherché literary game for the aristocracy. It was absurd to pretend, as Andreas Capellanus had done, that it had any existence in the real world. They'd say that the proof simply isn't there. I'd say it is. They were looking in the wrong century.
Wow, that's a succinct way to put it. Yes, absolutely. All right, so let's get to the Tudors. Let's get to Henry VII as the first Tudor. And one of the things you mentioned in the book is that part of the ways that Henry could sell himself as being the next king was based in romantic ideals. So how did that work?
Absolutely. And it's the Arthurian stories. I mean, kings before Henry had tried to use Arthur. And of course, you know, to us, Arthur is a legend. Then the distinction between legend, story, and history was, you know, rather more complex, rather more obscure than it seems today. So, you know, you'd had the Edward, the Hammer of the Scots, writing to the Pope saying he should be king over all the British Isles, just like his ancestor Arthur had done. So what Henry VII did in a way wasn't new, but certainly just before, well, 1485, two things happened. One of them was that Caxton printed Thomas Malory's Mort d'Arthur, the death of Arthur, which really put down all these big stories in the form in which basically they've come on to us today. What else happened in 1485? The Battle of Bosworth. And before the battle, Henry Tudor adopted as his standard the Red Dragon Dreadful. Red Dragon of Wales, of course, but also Malory had written that King Arthur dreamt of a battle where a dragon beat down a tyrant boar. The boar, of course, was the symbol of Richard III. Henry picked this up and ran with it, named his eldest son Arthur, made sure that the boy was born at Winchester, which Malory had identified as Camelot. And, you know, when Philip the Bold, Philip of Burgundy, star of the newly refashionable tournament, got blown onto English shores, he carted him to Winchester to show him King Arthur's round table hanging there.
Yeah,
and we know, of course, that not only Henry, but his wife, Elizabeth of York, had an interest here. I mean, there's her signature, Elizabeth the King's daughter, on a book of Arthurian romances in the Royal Library.
Yes, and they are able to spin this story as also being some rescuing by a handsome knight from across the sea, rescues this woman from her tyrant uncle. It's a good story.
It is, yeah. And of course, you know, at Henry's court, there was just on that kind of turning point where they began to see a distinction between history and story. Polydore Vergil, you know, the Italian humanist who Henry VII welcomed to his court, sniffed at the old Arthurian stories, Geoffrey of Monmouth and so on. But he actually had to kind of play that down a little bit if he wanted to please his royal masters.
And of course, Henry VII has Arthur. But Arthur dies, and then the next king to come up is Henry VIII, who we've heard lots of stories about. But it is very clear to me, I think, that he was very much steeped in this chivalric culture, this courtly love culture. It colors pretty much everything that he does, starting from when he's young. How does that work for Henry?
Yes, no, I totally agree with you. I mean, if you look at his education, it's clear that he was much taken with his mother's, the Yorkist side of the family, who were big on the tournament and, you know, all the kind of romantic, chivalric looking stuff. If you look at the tutors selected for him and for his younger sister, Mary, you can see where it's coming from. But from the earliest days, you know, Henry loved stories like Robin Hood. And right through into adulthood, I'd say, he was someone who wanted to look good to himself. To the rest of Europe, yes, but also to himself. And these chivalric fantasies allowed him to do it. I mean, you rightly, I think, mentioned to me rescue fantasy in the context of Henry VII coming in and marrying Elizabeth of York. But I think you can see it again with Henry VIII inheriting the throne, you know, just turning 18. And practically the first thing he does is to marry Catherine of Aragon, who, heaven knows, was at that point a princess in need of rescue, considering the very thin time she'd had of it in Henry VII's reign after Arthur died.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that Henry has to look good for himself. And one of the ways he does that is through disguise. And I think this is something that comes up quite a lot in his story. How does Henry disguise himself to kind of play this romantic hero?
Yes, I know. One doubts whether the disguises were really that convincing, his striking size. But yes, nonetheless, Catherine of Aragon and her ladies took care to be surprised, you know, and shocked when Robin Hood or, you know, Muscovite or whoever turned out to be, guess what, her own husband, Henry. And of course, in the early years, I know, I mean, you do sort of, you know, said, oh my God, not again, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, she knew her duty. She was sensible enough to, you know, never to do it aloud. Because in the early days, of course, at the tournaments he so loved, Henry rode as Coeur Loyal, Sir Loyalheart, and, you know, wearing Catherine of Aragon's, you know, initials, colours, whatever. And at the tournament after their first short-lived son was born, when his horse passed the place where Catherine of Aragon was sitting, he made it beat the wooden barricade with its hooves. I mean, you know, it was all on a note of high fantasy stuff. And Henry wasn't the only one playing this game, in a way. Ambassadors compared him, said that the court was more splendid than anything, you know, since King Arthur's day. So everyone was quite happy to see him in those terms.
Yes, especially Henry. And I think this is kind of skipping ahead a bit and we can come back. But I think something that you mentioned is that Henry shows up when it's time to meet Anne of Cleves. He's also in disguise and she doesn't play the game. And I had never thought of it in those terms, but he's immediately turned off not only by her looks, but she won't play the game with him.
Yeah. No, totally. And I'm not sure it's much won't as she didn't know how to.
Yeah.
Because, as you say, when Anne of Cleves was travelling into England, and Henry had been really excited about this, you know, this foreign princess, the first time he'd had a foreign princess for years, you know, furbishing up the court, hiring musicians and so on, polishing up his own skills. And he went hot foot down to meet her on her journey through England at Rochester. And he came into her disguised as the messenger who was merely bringing a gift from the king. And of course, in theory, Anne was supposed, you know, the eye of true love is supposed to penetrate any disguise. This disguise thing is a really regular courtly love trope. Unfortunately, Anne of Cleves had no background to play this game because she'd been raised in a very different tradition, where it was held as sinful for ladies to, oh, know foreign languages, read stories, play musical instruments. So she was very, very far from the kind of cultural leading light, courtly leading light, courtly lady that Henry was hoping for. I mean, what gets me particularly about that story is that go back a couple of few generations and Henry VI had gone down in disguise to meet Marguerite of Anjou, similarly, when she arrived in England. Marguerite of Anjou, actually, although she was raised in the courtly tradition, similarly failed to recognise Henry at once. But Henry VI didn't hold it against her. And yet he's the one we think of as the Mad King.
I don't think Henry VI held a lot of things against a lot of people. He seemed like quite a sweet man.
Yeah, indeed, yes.
Okay, so getting back to the other Anne, She is one person who knew how to play the game like an expert. How was Anne's upbringing a way to really teach her how to play this courtly love game that really ensnared Henry VIII?
Well, if we think of England as being, as perhaps it was, I often think of some of the sort of great cultural movements moving slowly northwards through Europe. And so England maybe could tend to get them a little bit late. But Anne Boleyn had been educated on the continent at some of the most cultured courts around. When she was 13, she was sent fairly briefly to act as maid to Margaret of Austria, the regent of the Netherlands. And Margaret was a massively cultivated woman who composed a patron, composed music, and herself played the courtly game with pleasure. Though while Anne Boleyn was there, she actually got caught in its toils a bit. Then Anne Boleyn, of course, went on to France to serve Mary Tudor and then remain in France for some number of years. She was on the continent, you know, for about 7 years, while even long after Mary Tudor had gone back home. And there, again, later evidence would suggest that she met Marguerite of Navarre, King Francois's, again, highly cultured sister. Someone else, actually, interestingly, who had got caught in the courtly love trap. You know, so the lessons Anne Boleyn took back to England with her were complicated ones. But it seems highly likely, virtually certain, in fact, that though reports suggest Anne Boleyn was not an out-and-out beauty by the standards of the 16th century, that she was an absolute adept in the courtly arts. And that's what made the appeal to Henry. Because, you know, he'd loved Catherine of Aragon, he'd played the courtly game with her, but courtly love and marriage were always very uneasy bedfellows. And it was never really, you know, up for the courtly love creed for the long haul, in a sense, for the long married haul, the day in, day out, Catherine of Aragon aging. She was a little older than Henry, of course, and the disappointments of childbed. Henry was kind of ripe for someone else to come and steam in and help him play this wonderful, glamorous game. And Anne was, you know, 100% cut out to do it.
Yes, even her critics say she wasn't good looking and she was scandalous, but, you know, she was great at playing music. She was very smart. We have to give her that.
Yes.
So what were some of the ways in which Anne played this courtly love game in order to get Henry's attention?
Of course, our best evidence as to their courtship comes from the love letters, the 16 love letters we have that Henry wrote to Anne Boleyn. They're in the Vatican archive now, probably taken there by a spy. If only we had Anne's letters back, we'd actually know a lot more about the real woman. We don't. But we can guess at something of their content, you know, from the tone in which Henry was writing. Even though he's the king, he writes, you know, as Anne's servant and saying that his heart and all commend it, you know, into her hands. He's there to do her bidding. He is the king. He doesn't altogether keep up this lovely fantasy all along. But by then, of course, other factors had come into play. One is the question of whether it was Anne who held Henry at bay sexually for all those long 7 years in which they were courting, or whether it was Henry himself who was actually, you know, holding off because by this point he wanted to make Anne his wife and any child they had to be legitimate. But there was a whole lot about their courtship that really did fit into the courtly pattern. I mean, the courtly lady, well, she was supposed ideally, you know, to be of higher status than the man. That couldn't really work out with the king. But she was also supposed to be a kind of moral leader. And of course, Anne was leading Henry towards an element of reform in faith, you know, not out and out Protestantism, but certainly, you know, querying papal authority. She was supposed to be skilled, and we know that Anne was that. She was supposed to be chaste and virtuous in some ways. And I always think it's noticeable that when Cardinal Wolsey's been recruited reluctantly to the cause, and he's writing letters to other grandees trying to explain why Anne Boleyn really is the best bride for Henry, he kind of pitches it on her virtue and her chastity.
It's a tricky thing that the cardinal had to do.
It is, yes, and I'm very sure he didn't really relish the task. But
no, I don't think so. So eventually, things work out, quote unquote, work out for Henry and Anne, and they are married, and then things go south immediately.
I know, it's amazing how short a time that marriage actually lasts, isn't it? From the time the marriage was revealed to Anne's death, 3 years.
Yes.
And one strong factor is likely to have been that tempting but dangerous courtly love game. I mean, historians still argue a lot over what actually brought about the fall of Anne Boleyn. And the answer is probably that it's a perfect storm of Henry's pressing need for a male son, political factors between France and Spain even, Anne's falling out with Cromwell, court faction. But at the very least, courtly love, that adulterous ethic, gave a weapon into Cromwell's hands. Because although Anne, you know, recent work on her has often tended, and rightly, to play up the strength of her feeling for religious reform, there was something lighter as well. There was this pastime in the Queen's chamber. There was all this music, dancing, all those flirtatious remarks, which would then be used in evidence against her, you know, with men like Norris and Weston and even Smeaton. You know, the sort of question, who is it you love best? Why, madam, it's you, of course. You know, absolutely standard courtly stuff, but it could be turned against Anne. It really does look as though the minute Anne was his wife rather than his courtly mistress, Henry expected different things of Anne. And Anne may not altogether have understood that. After all, she wasn't a European princess with a powerful family behind her. Really, all she had was that kind of personal fascination she'd exerted on Henry. And if that died away under the kind of unromantic influence of the marriage bed, then really, what was she? Unless she'd been able to provide Henry with the son, in which case...
Yes, and there isn't a lot of precedent for that in the stories. No one usually marries the woman that they are pursuing because she's usually already married. And so there's no precedent. What is Anne supposed to do?
No, that's right. Or alternatively, she becomes unavailable in other ways. I mean, it's notable that both Dante and Petrarch used the courtly love tradition. And of course, both Beatrice and Laura were dead. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't be much more unavailable than that, I guess you could say. But that's exactly right. And of course, again, this is skipping forward to a massive degree. But when over the centuries after the Tudors, courtly love got sort of co-opted into a much broader ideas of romance, still, most traditional novels end at the church door. Mm-hmm. Reader, I married him, you
yes.
know?
Yes.
It's all about the chase, not about what comes after.
And what Henry wanted when they got married was Jane Seymour, because yeah. She's the complete opposite. She's the complete opposite. It's not funny, but it's just like the turnaround that Anne was meant to make on that day is just is unbelievable.
Yes, I know.
We don't have a lot of time to get through Henry's other wives, and I think that it's safe to say that the courtly love thing failed with Catherine Howard, and then he needed the stability of Catherine Parr at the end. But we should get to Elizabeth, because you do mention Elizabeth too. So how does courtly love figure in Elizabeth's life?
Hugely. differently because, of course, you know, she was the monarch. She was both the lady. She was almost both the lady and the lord. But it features hugely. It's hard almost to remember now just how controversial Elizabeth's monarchy seemed at first. Yes, there'd been her sister Mary as the first really ruling queen in England. But A, Mary had married, and B, also as a Catholic queen, she was in a sense under the Pope's spirit, you know, the spiritual authority of Rome. When Elizabeth came to the throne, I mean, we remember her, we think of her as the Virgin Queen, but for all the first years of her reign, absolutely everyone assumed that she, like her sister, would have to marry. And it was only really as it became more and more apparent that she wasn't going to. And then when, you know, finally she passed out of the years of fertility, so in a sense there was no point anyway, there had to be a language, a code again, to make acceptable this deeply controversial unmarried female monarchy. We know a lot of work's been done on how Elizabeth and those around her used all sorts of, you know, of tropes, of patterns. I mean, if you look at her portraits, there's the sieve portrait, which references the Roman Vestal Virgin who proved her chastity by walking through the streets carrying a sieve of water. There's all the echoes of the Virgin Mary. There were all sorts of classical heroines referenced, even in the pageantry of Elizabeth's coronation. But as the years wore on, the old courtly and even Arthurian stories start to come more and more to the fore. I mean, the Cecils, you know, Elizabeth's great ministers, kept at their house a family tree showing Elizabeth's descent from King Arthur. You know, so much for the new history. But also, if you look at the patterns of Elizabeth's behaviour with her courtiers and theirs towards her, it's bang on courtly love stuff. It really explains it in a way nothing else can. Because Elizabeth's courtiers, her favourites, men like Leicester, Hatton, Raleigh, and indeed Essex, hailed her as a almost like a goddess come to earth. You wonder how they could do it and still keep a straight face. They were supposed to be struck in this kind of kneeling posture of adoration for the absolute goddess that was Elizabeth for years on end. And you feel, okay, you know, in an age when men actually expected to be the bosses, how did they manage it? How did they convince themselves? And the answer, of course, is this is absolutely core courtly love stuff. And really, at every point, the rules of courtly love, the identity of the courtly lady, fits for Elizabeth. I mean, the courtly lady was supposed to be demanding, capricious, test her lover's fidelity. Well, that wasn't going to be too much of a problem for Elizabeth, was it? You know, I feel that one came to her really rather naturally. The courtly lady was supposed to be a moral leader so that she could, you know, raise her lover up spiritually. You didn't get much higher than the woman who was supposed to be the leader for the, you know, religion of her country, leading the Church of England. 3 years into Elizabeth's reign, Castiglione's Book of the Courtier was translated into English, and it says that if the courtly lady has a pure love for the noble courtier, both may attain absolute perfection. So it really is that moral thing which Henry VIII used and Elizabeth did too. But there's other things too. I mean, the gender role reversal in courtly love. And C.S. Lewis pointed out that, you know, Midon, the way the lover addressed his lady, actually comes not from my lady, but from my lord in language terms. Anyway, that echoes, in a sense, this idea of the queen's two bodies, that the reigning queen was in one sense female and fallible, but in another kind of completely genderless, a prince as well as a princess. And you do just go on finding it. And of course, courtly love licensed the flirtations that Elizabeth herself so enjoyed.
I was thinking about that too, yeah. How she obviously had flirtations and people were probably speculating. We know they were speculating about who she might be taking to her bedroom. But as you say, there's this language, there's this cultural tradition in which it's always chaste. That's how it is. And so we just don't talk about the fact that it might not be.
No, quite. And also there's an interesting, the definition of the word chaste, term chaste can be an interesting one. Andreas Capellanus, you know, back in the 12th century, wrote that the lover may enjoy the naked embraces of his lady in a bed, and yet their love may be accounted pure if the final solace is denied to them. I think we can guess what the final solace is. You know, who knows? Maybe those were the rules that Henry and Anne had used, Elizabeth's parents had used. And they may well have been the rules that she herself used with Robert Dudley.
Yes, solaces. I love that in Andreas's work. That's such a couch term, and we all know what it means, and who's expecting we would all know what it means.
Yes, absolutely.
So to turn a little bit, you talk a lot about the rumors that swirl around. So in this book, you have a lot of places where you say, it was said that, it was said that. And I think that's important because as long as we are clear on, you know, this is gossip, I think that's really important to have in this book because it's all about appearances. So how does spinning it for the public work, do you think, when it comes to the Tudors and courtly love?
Right. Well, I think the first thing to say is that for fact, fiction, fake news, forget any of the current political figures, commend me to a Tudor statesman any day. Yeah, I think in a way it ties into that thing we were talking about earlier, that real lack of a hard dividing line between fantasy and history. As you say, as you suggest, appearance was all, especially, of course, in an age when, you know, there weren't our, you couldn't look at a news report from a foreign country, you know, and look and say, well, that's not what I'm seeing on camera. It was all about perception. But I think that that consciousness, if you like, that it was all about perception was a very important part of the political game. In a sense, sorry, this sounds off piece, but it isn't really. In a sense, one way that, say, the pretender to Henry VII's throne, Perkin Warbeck, how he could be so successful is he looked like a prince. He seemed like a prince. And by the rules of the day, that was kind of halfway to being a prince. So it really was possible to use elements of kind of communal fantasy to really, really bolster, affect the actions of reality.
Yes, this is something that I think that all of the Tudors really lean on, but especially Henry VIII and Elizabeth.
Yes, yes, definitely.
So you mentioned the Tudors in the subtitle of your book as being the last medieval dynasty. What do you think changed when Elizabeth passed and it became the realm of James the First?
Yes. Well, I do rather feel that most of Europe had not necessarily given up on the game of courtly love, but put it in its place, if you like. I always wonder if this is one reason why Mary, Queen of Scots, who we think of as a romantic figure, actually didn't really show the same signs the Tudors did of, you know, of being in thrall to courtly love. I think, in a sense, it was passing out of European consciousness as anything other than something for a mask sort of thing. I think in the latter years of Elizabeth, you can see the game becoming pretty attenuated, pretty, you know, worn out, though in a way all the more hyperbolic for that. I mean, Essex, the Earl of Essex, Elizabeth's last great favourite, and Leicester's stepson, absolutely used the language of courtly love, but, you know, he did it when writing of Elizabeth and to her, you know, writing of, oh, wanting to conquer her resisting will, the light of her windows would be the poles that would guide his ships home from abroad. This, although she was, of course, you know, three decades older than he. So the game was sort of becoming a bit overblown, I think, in the last years of Elizabeth's reign, to the point where really it had to crash and fall. But certainly James of Scotland, James Stuart, was not a man to have any truck with this kind of fantasy. You know, he wasn't big on romance. He was not big on women having any kind of power or authority. And of course, he'd been raised in the quite extreme Protestant tradition, which was no friend to courtly love. It's arguable that the Catholic religion, with, you know, the female saints, with the reverence paid given to the Virgin Mary, had far more space for this kind of secular religion of courtly love. The Protestant world that was coming in really didn't.
I think that's very true. I think that it has a lot to do with James's personality, but also the cultural shifts towards Protestantism that were really full steam ahead at that time.
Yeah. I mean, it's notable that one of James's chief obsessions, of course, was the pursuit of mostly female witches.
Yeah.
And that's almost like the polar opposite of subscribing to courtly love.
Yes. No power at all to the ladies in this, no thrall. And it is interesting when we think of it in those terms, because it is almost like a magical thrall that women have over men. Yeah. If you look at Lancelot,
well,
especially.
Yes, well, indeed. And of course, it is notable, it was suggested that Anne Boleyn was, you know, she wasn't technically accused at her trial of witchcraft, but the suspicions were there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this is an excellent way to look at the Tudors, and a nice, refreshing way of pulling them back into that medieval world that they really worked at keeping a hold of, I think.
Yeah. Well, they absolutely did, yes. And of course, you know, the early days of Henry VIII's reign and Henry VII's saw a lot of rediscovery of medieval scholarship. Mm-hmm. You know, indeed, you could even see Anne Boleyn being actively involved in it.
Yes. And of course, historical lines when we talk about periods are always going to be mixed up and messy. But I think it's a good way to look at the Tudors as being a continuous part of history instead of a big sharp line saying this is now the early modern period. But thank you so much, Sarah, for coming on and telling us about the Tudors and love.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
To find out more about Sarah's work, you can visit her website at saragristwood.com or follow her on Twitter at @SarahGristwood. Her new book is The Tudors in Love, The Courtly Code Behind the Last Medieval Dynasty. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's new this week, Peter?
Hey, hey. I guess the big news has to do with Edward the Black Prince. For all you 14th century English history fans, they have gone into his tomb at Canterbury Cathedral and took a look at the kind of armor effigy for him and found out some interesting results and some really great pictures too. So if you want to know what the inside of that effigy looks like, check it out. We're starting up again, like new medieval books. So hopefully I'll be doing that like once a week for the rest of the year. We have a lot of books to tell you about. And also the Salt Mafia.
A Salt Mafia? What's a Salt Mafia?
9th century Tang China, salt was a big deal. Half the government revenue came from salt taxes, and that encouraged crime. And that also would lead to rebellion. So yeah, that's a pretty good article there from one of our columnists.
Well, this all sounds awesome. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks.
As I mentioned last week, it's time for a new session of the Medieval Masterclass for Creators. So if you're interested in learning a whole lot about the medieval world in order to fuel your own creative project, please visit medievalmasterclass.com, where you can check out the classic version or the brand new Express option, which I've just dropped. The Medieval Masterclass Express is a pared-down, streamlined version of the class that I've tailored to those people who are working on a more limited budget or those who prefer to take in their content on their own schedule. You can sign up and get to work right away, which is perfect for those writers who are participating in NaNoWriMo this month. Just saying. If you're interested in the Meteor Classic 6-week masterclass with its 2 live classes and yours truly as your own personal research assistant, the new session begins November 5th. So don't wait. Get yourself to medievalmasterclass.com and I'll see you there. In other news, a couple of weeks ago, the Medieval Podcast passed 1 million downloads across platforms. I remember celebrating 100,000 and being over the moon at reaching the population of a small city with my little homemade project. And now I'm at 1 million. It is a tough number to wrap my head around, let me tell you. But that is a problem I am more than happy to have. Of course, I would never have reached 1 million without the backing of Medievalist.net, my sound editors over the past 2 years, and the amazing guests who make the medieval world come alive for us all. I know that 1 million isn't just new strangers every week, but a whole lot of you who come back week after week to spend your time with me and learning about the past. I've had messages from teachers, long-haul truck drivers, heavy equipment operators, IT professionals, parents, and all sorts of people in between, and I want to thank you all for jumping into the past with me and sharing my enthusiasm for some really cool history. It's been a dream, and I'm not finished yet. Thanks for letting me live it. Thank you also forever and always to our patrons on patreon.com for all your generous support each month. We have great stuff for patrons like subscriptions to Medieval Warfare Magazine and the Medieval Magazine, our book club, and our exclusive maps by Tina Ross. To get in on all the action, please visit patreon.com/medievalists. For everything from tutors to trebuchets, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalist. You can find me, Danielle Cebulski, on social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. And you can find my books at all your favorite online bookstores, where you can even pre-order How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life, which will be out in hardcover and ebook on November 23rd. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself a wonderful day.